You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. It seems that plans for war and even plans for peace are assembled behind closed doors these days. The result is what we've seen in the past year. Bellicose political leaders who at times seem out of step with both their parties and their people. Today on Peace Watch, we take a look behind those closed doors at the military planners in the so-called war room and the alternative vision of the peace room. This is the fourth of a five-part series from producer Michelle Ernsting of Radio Netherlands entitled War of Words.
And we, the democracies of this world,
we will use whatever means are necessary to achieve our objective.
The war room is where cutting-edge technology is used to calculate the strategies and risks of violence. Top secret, behind closed doors, with a handful of powerful individuals. In this program, we look at the work of three people who are trying to open up this process in an effort to avoid violent confrontation. From Geneva, Johan Galtung, known as the founder of Peace Studies. Gene Sharp, acting president of the Albert Einstein Institution and perhaps the world's top advisor on nonviolent struggle. And finally, Scott Jones. Jones is less well known in connection with peace work, and that's because he's a former U.S. commander. Much of his work involved devising new, and at times unusual, methods of gaining information from adversaries. This information was for use in war rooms. Now, in his retirement, he's created what he calls the Peace Room.
I'm Scott Jones, and I represent the Peace Incorporated, and that's an acronym for Peace and Emergency Action Coalition for Earth. And our concept is to take what we have learned from the sophisticated war room and develop an equivalency, and we call it the Peace Room. It will look very much like a war room as far as equipment is concerned, computers, very sophisticated display equipment, and communication, global link by satellites. These will be, when the system is fully deployed, will be regional peace rooms around the world. The genesis of this idea is that we look at the success, the power of the war room in developing war strategies, war gaming, and then in implementing that. And we feel that we need something as capable, as powerful for peace. It will give us tools that the peacemakers have never had, and hopefully we will for the first time be able to articulate peace strategies. I spent 30 years in the military, and I spent a lot of time in war rooms, and so I have hands-on experience and know how capable they are, and this is why I've used that model.
Johan Galtung, born in Norway, and I am now co-director of Transcend, which is an organization for peaceful transformation of conflict. And I've personally been involved in about 45 conflicts. It's a number growing. We are now touching 50. And by being involved means to have dialogues with all the parties and then trying to come up with some image of what a solution could look like. I'd like to underline the word dialogue. That means not debating, but trying to search questions. And I would like to underline the word all. There are always more than two parties to a conflict. And I would like to underline the word solution, positive image of what could happen, what could be a good outcome.
America wants the UN to be an effective organization that helps keep the peace. And that is why we are urging the Security Council to adopt a new resolution setting out tough, immediate requirements.
There is absolutely no reason to trust these treaties at all. And often, more often than not, they even have secret clauses. The negotiations take place behind closed doors. I myself have, on a couple of occasions, been behind those closed doors. And I think I can say one reason why those doors are closed. What goes on is often so stupid, so immoral, so arm-twisting, that if people should see it, they would lose absolutely all respect for that process. What happens in the end behind those closed doors very often early in the morning is that they polish up a communique and then the door opens, a guy comes out and he reads it. The journalists are there, it's a photo opportunity, TV crews are there, 5 o'clock in the morning, the fridge is open, the champagne is out, and they are toasting to each other. And people have a feeling that these people have been working very hard and given them peace as a gift. I think very mistaken.
And who are the people behind the closed doors?
They would, of course, generally be from the foreign offices. People from other ministries would be called in, and they would be experts as advisors. Those experts would more often than not come from governmentally sponsored institutes. If you look at a room, you will find about 90 to 95% being men, most of them middle-aged. There are very few cases where they are blessed with the wisdom of the really old person. And they would certainly not be blessed with the impatience of young people for a real solution. More often than not, it's done by diplomats. Diplomats are well trained. They are known for being diplomatic, which means they will probably not have bursts of anger. They will probably talk with a calm voice. But, and then comes the big but, they are representatives of their government. And their government has something called national interest. And those national interests may be an important part of the conflict. In other words, it is not to be assumed that a diplomat can enter as an uninterested party. And I noticed that myself, since I'm doing much of the same kind of thing, sitting with presidents, for instance, prime ministers, foreign ministers, and people who are leaders of NGOs or rank-and-file members of NGOs or just ordinary, regular people, sitting having dialogues, and usually the flow is very, very easy, and they answer very easily, and they put their own questions and things of that kind. And in the end, they get the reaction. Namely, it's so wonderful, they say, to talk with somebody who doesn't have a hidden agenda, because when we talk with an ambassador from the other country, any other country, there is always a hidden agenda. So that comes up as a big problem. Maybe the world has used the wrong people.
Looking at the exterior of a peace room,
it looks like a bunker.
Yes, it does, but there's lots of glass, as you will see it, poorly designed for combat. What we will have when we get inside of the peace room is what we call an electronic library, and what is being depicted now is the various parts of the peace room. This is the administrative offices, which are just very typical of any organization. And in another tower of this particular building is the sophisticated or the electronic library and archives. And this will be available, and we will offer scholarships and fellowships to students and to faculty members that come in and work in the peace room. The database essentially will be online. It will tap into the libraries of the world and to the archives of the world. And as you can see here, there are a number of workstations. We expect the media of the region to all use this. It will be a place where reporters who are interested in investigative reporting can really get data from the world. Also, it will be open to individual members of parliaments and congresses of the region. This is a acknowledgement that in countries in where there is a clearly defined executive and legislature, usually the legislature is at a serious disadvantage as far as knowledge of what even their own country is doing. And so committees and commissions and individual members of legislatures and parliament can come and use the peace room to help them give direction and guidance and oversee what the executive branches are doing.
Transcend was doing some work in Kabul, and the whole ministry was sitting there in front of us. So I was talking about the importance of democracy, and democracy means not only elections, but it means that there is something potentially valid in the other guy. And for that reason, you need a dialogue. You need questioning, mutual questioning, and try to see whether you and he could come up with a third position that would be even better. So I concluded saying that elections are important, but maybe the critical key element in democracy is dialogue. Then the guy stood up, high up in the ministry, and he said, I find that very, very interesting. Now, United States is a democracy, but when did United States have a dialogue with Al-Qaeda? I would just like to know when that happened. So evidently it didn't happen. Colin Powell came out immediately and said, we'll identify where Al-Qaeda is and crush it. And this, I think, is the whole idea of the word terrorist, that you try to design an enemy with whom it is useless, futile. And indeed, not only that, but also a sign of your own potential weakness if you start dialoguing. Because the terrorist doesn't have arguments. He's only out to do one thing, spread terror, and that's because he's evil, and he wants to wreak havoc, and he wants to spread his evil. The moment you have a dialogue with him, you are legitimizing him, and you're helping him. Now, that's a position one has to get out of. This is a very strongly fundamentalist, anti-human position. And one way of getting out of it is by asking yourself, how do these people look at me? And you'll find out that they look at you exactly the same way. And that's the reason why they committed violence against some buildings on 11 September, instead of entering in dialogue, because they had a feeling it was impossible to have dialogue with you.
It's our observation that there is a considerable amount of inequity between knowledge of countries of the world. For example, any country who goes into negotiations with a country such as the United States that has an extensive global intelligence gathering network are at a real disadvantage as far as the so-called facts of the issue may be. The database of the peace room will be available to everyone. One of the ground rules will be if one of the parties to a dispute asks for a particular file, they will get it with the understanding that the same information will be provided to the other side. So that when they sit around the table and start, there shouldn't be the feeling that anyone is at a great disadvantage. And hopefully we can get over the issue of facts very quickly. And if there is a will to really seriously negotiate and to compromise, we'll get to that point much quicker.
The atmosphere may also be one of bullying. And it may simply be that a big power, a very big power, in the end gets impatient and is able to trump its line through. And there will then have been quite a lot of arm twisting in the corridors. And that arm twisting in the corridors would then be accompanied by a couple of arguments, for instance, using alliance pressure. This is where we count on your loyalty. This is where your solidarity is being tested. You are a member of this alliance because you want our protection. Well, you'll not get that protection unless you are with us now. You are a member of this alliance because, generally speaking, you trust our map of the world. We've told you what the map is. You still seem to have some grievances. I'll suggest that you bury those for the duration of this conference. Things of that kind. And there could be arm twisting in the sense of threatening to raise the level of interest on a loan, not making loans available, and, of course, outright bombing, which, of course, was the method that was used in connection with the disastrous events that led to the bombing of Yugoslavia. So you can have the total breakdown, but you can also have the opposite. You can also have a very calm sailing and agreement. And now, you see, I happen to be even more skeptical about the second. Because if you have people who are so uniform, so similar, trained the same way, looking at the world the same way, agreeing, it may be they agree about the wrong thing. And the question is how to price it open and to get much more participation in the process, much more democracy. And one formula is that the conflict worker should know about general conflict theory, but not too much about that specific conflict. That should be the local guy, whether that's an NGO person or a president. And he'll teach you. You will ask him, and he'll inform you. So sometimes I would recommend the more naive. But the person should be well-trained in general theory and practice of conflict, point one. Point two, not have any personal interest, no hidden agenda. It is perfectly okay to have likes and dislikes. It would be completely non-human not to have that. And in no way should a person be neutral. You should not be neutral between a slave and a slave owner. We are not there to negotiate a compromise between them. But, to use that metaphor, I would be very sensitive to the slave owner's argument, what's going to happen to me if slavery is abolished. It'll be a ruin, my family, my children, it'll be a disaster. And I would sit with him and try to develop together with him ways of solving that problem. So the word is not neutrality, but you should be explicit in your commitment to creativity and peacefulness. Point three, how shall I say it? There is a certain way, there is a model I have in mind, which is kind of conversation between British gentlemen of the upper classes, sort of sitting relaxed in a chair. You should have good manners, be charming. You should radiate optimism. You should not be too moralizing. You may have a couple of remarks of that kind. You should not be put off by negativism on the other side, but patiently continue. You should stick to the idea of asking questions. But what is not okay is when you're no longer sensitive to arguments from the other side. And then you look at all of this, and my experience is that something emerges. But it takes more than knowledge, it takes intuition, and it is almost a spiritual experience. And you almost feel it physically, you see. You almost feel the jump in your tummy and in your little brain. And that is fascinating.
The next section is what we call the solarium, and that's spelled S-O-U-L. It is a place for meditation, prayer, contemplation. And that, of course, is open to the staff and to the people in training there and to the negotiators. It acknowledges that, in our view, there is a very important spiritual component to peace, and until that is honored and recognized, if we only look at the political and the economics component, we're not going to get it, and nothing will really be permanent until we look at the cultures and let them flower in full expression. Then we will have a chance of developing strategies that will ultimately give us peace with justice.
Gene Sharp believes the way to peace is through conflict, non-violent conflict. Conflicts, he believes, are often unavoidable and sometimes desirable. Violence is what causes people to suffer. Therefore, he's helped to create a kind of blueprint for bloodless battle. The philosophy of nonviolence has inspired some of the great people power movements of the last century. The struggle for independence of the Baltic states. The resistance to the dictatorship in Burma. The Velvet Revolution in Czechoslovakia.
Zdravím jménem občanského fóra i všechny občany, kteří nejsou zde na pražském Václavském náměstí a sledují nás prostřednictvím televize.
The strategy is complex but methodical.
There appears to be a tremendous resistance to accepting the fact that nonviolent struggle can often be highly successful, where violent struggle almost certainly would have been crushed, and that the fact that this has happened not one or two times, but dozens of times, has profound implications for how conflict is conducted, which challenge the established assumption that violence is the real power. Military means are the only thing that really counts. And you have this accumulated evidence that that's not true, but people somehow, in general, seem incapable of challenging that fundamental assumption about violence. Nonviolent struggle, also called nonviolent action, is a technique for conducting, waging conflict through precise methods. Symbolic protest activities, for example, like picketing and handing out leaflets or hoisting a forbidden flag. Non-cooperation, like social boycotts, economic boycotts, labor strikes, and many kinds of political non-cooperation, which people in all those areas, they don't do what they're told to do or supposed to do. That has the potential for slowing down the system or maybe even paralyzing it. And the last class is nonviolent intervention, in which people engage in disruptive activities like a sit-in or hunger strike, which is psychologically disruptive, or even constituting an illegal parallel government. For oppressed groups, they aren't usually able to wage violent struggle effectively. Or if they attempt to do it through guerrilla warfare or terrorism, they also may lose.
In Moscow, it now appears that 50 Chechen rebels were killed when Russian troops stormed a theater where over 800 hostages were being held. Directly after the hostages were freed, the Russian army launched a major offensive in Chechnya.
If you are able to challenge the regime seriously, you have to expect casualties. Now, you won't have as many dead, by far, than if you challenged militarily or paramilitarily. Your statistics for casualties are there. Some extreme cases like Tiananmen Square and the year before in Rangoon, they're high. Mostly those are exceptions. But you have to calculate that this is a conflict with a violent regime, which will not give up its power easily.
If we have to act, we will plan carefully, with the full power of the United States military, and we will prevail.
The peace room will look and operate very much like a war room. It will have an extensive global database of what we call the correlates of war and peace. And we ask ourselves the question, well, what has man found to fight over the years? And it's virtually everything. I mean, we've fought over ideas, we've fought over territory. And so the database that will be constructed and maintained will be an extraordinarily broad and extensive database. And it will be global. That will be the responsibility of the regional peace rooms to establish and maintain their database for their area. The data will be used in the regional peace rooms in the training of, we hope, junior foreign service officers using real data. And this will bring a degree of realism in their training that otherwise might not be there, because they can use the data that addresses the issues that are potentially war-making issues between countries of the region. And so if they will learn their peacemaking skills and their arbitration skills using real data, we think that will be a plus.
There seems to be a growth in the 20th century in the politically relevant application of nonviolent struggle. Often by people who really didn't know what they were doing, and they were improvising and keeping their big toes crossed and so forth. In the period of 89 to 91 in Eastern Europe was one that shook up so many people, whether it's the tearing down of the Berlin Wall, you know, whether it's the defiance in Estonia and nearby Latvia and Lithuania, these tiny countries fighting their way nonviolently, consciously nonviolently, against the massive, all-powerful Soviet Union and winning. during those periods, people can see that it made an effect. We don't have it documented very well, but I think there's been a massive and very significant growth in the practice of nonviolent struggle in real conflicts. The second reason is that there's been, in the past 40 years or so, a very significant growth in academic study of nonviolent action. What is it? What's its theory? What's its historical record? What are its methods? How does it work in conflicts with highly repressive regimes? And that's knowledge people in earlier decades didn't have. And that's very important, because sometimes there are people that actually go to the libraries and go to the books to try to figure out how they could act in the future.
This, I think, is where strategic peace gaming will take place, where countries can really determine what risks there are in going for peace. And there are always risks in peacemaking. But using the database and some special programs that we're developing, they can do peace gaming and make some determinations, really how far they're willing to go at this time. And we assume that when they have confidence in the peace room and know it's a place that they can trust and that the data is really unbiased, it's as accurate as it can be and available to everyone, they will use it and know that it is safe to use it. I hope it becomes competitive. I hope Pakistan says, well, if India is going to have one, we have to have one too, and I would be delighted to be a part of a peace race, and perhaps that will be one of the flowers that will blossom out of this approach.
Some people think you have to reach a higher level of moral development before you can give up violence. I think that's utter nonsense. Plain, ordinary, obnoxious, cussed people have used this for centuries. And it doesn't require anything like that. They do need to have a kind of a spirit of struggle, the warrior spirit, the spirit of fighting.
The real thing in the world are human beings. And the purpose of the whole thing, the whole exercise, is not to augment the power of the state, which is the fascist idea, or to augment the strength of the economic system, which is the capitalist idea. The purpose is to reduce human suffering and increase human fulfillment. And that seems to me to be two very basic aspects of conflict work. You reduce the suffering due to violence, and unfulfilled expectations, because a conflict is always frustrating. Your goals have been frustrated. And then the fulfillment. You try to show a possibility that is even more than you asked for.
And I must say that the Peace Room fully acknowledges the extensive work, lifelong work, of many people in this field who entered it long before we did. And there are some brilliant ideas out there that we will simply make room for in the regional peace room. They can set up their operations and work there. We are only part of the solution. Peace is a very complex, and the solution to peace will be equally complex. And so, you know, we just want to play our part and welcome the other peace workers with open hearts.
You've been listening to The Peace Room, part of the Sound Fountain series War of Words, produced and presented by Michelle Ernsting.
Next Friday on Peace Watch, we present the fifth and final part of the series. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. by Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias, and our engineer is Granger Helvey. We had production assistance from Adil Hamad of KPFA, Reem Kathuda, Bentha Berkland, and Marcus Tyler Brown. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thank you for listening.